The Road to Serfdom, Drick A. Hayek, continued, Cassette 2, Side 2. The alleged technological cause of the growth of monopoly is the superiority of the large firm over the small, owing to the greater efficiency of modern methods of mass production. Modern methods, it is asserted, have created conditions in the majority of industries where the production of the large firm can be increased at decreasing costs per unit, with the result that the large firms are everywhere underbidding and driving out the small ones. This process must go on until in each industry only one or at most a few giant firms are left. This argument singles out one effect sometimes accompanying technological progress. It disregards others which work in the opposite direction, and it receives little support from a serious study of the facts. We cannot here investigate this question in detail, and must be content to accept the best evidence available. The most comprehensive study of the facts undertaken in recent times is that by the temporary National Economic Committee on the Concentration of Economic Power. The final report of this committee, which certainly cannot be accused of an undue liberal bias, arrives at the conclusion that the view according to which the greater efficiency of large-scale production is the cause of the disappearance of competition finds scant support in any evidence that is now at hand. And the detailed monograph on the question which was prepared for the committee sums up the answer in this statement. The superior efficiency of large establishments has not been demonstrated. The advantages that are supposed to destroy competition have failed to manifest themselves in many fields, nor do the economies of size, where they exist, invariably necessitate monopoly. The size or the sizes of the optimum efficiency may be reached long before the major part of a supply is subjected to such control. The conclusions that the advantage of large-scale production must lead inevitably to the abolition of competition cannot be accepted. It should be noted, moreover, that monopoly is frequently the product of factors other than the lower costs of greater size. It is attained through collusive agreement and promoted by public policies. When these agreements are invalidated and when these policies are reversed, competitive conditions can be restored. An investigation of conditions in England would lead to very similar results. Anyone who has observed how aspiring monopolists regularly seek and frequently obtain the assistance of the power of the state to make their control effective can have little doubt that there is nothing inevitable about this development. This conclusion is strongly supported by the historical order in which the decline of competition and the growth of monopoly manifested themselves in different countries. If they were the result of technological developments or a necessary product of evolution of capitalism, we should expect them to appear first in the countries with the most advanced economic system. In fact, they appeared first during the last third of the 19th century in what were then comparatively young industrial countries, the United States and Germany. In the latter country especially, which came to be regarded as the model country typifying the necessary evolution of capitalism, the growth of cartels and syndicates has since 1878 been systematically fostered by deliberate policy. Not only the instrument of protection, but direct inducements and ultimately compulsion were used by the governments to further the creation of monopolies for the regulation of prices and sales. It was here that, with the help of the state, the first great experiment in scientific planning and conscious organization of industry led to the creation of giant monopolies, which were represented as inevitable growths 50 years before the same was done in Great Britain. It is largely due to the influence of German socialist theoreticians, particularly Sombart, generalizing from the experience of their country, that the inevitable development of the competitive system into monopoly capitalism became widely accepted. That in the United States a highly policy made a somewhat similar development possible seemed to confirm this generalization. The development of Germany, however, more than that of the United States, came to be regarded as representative of a universal tendency, and it became a commonplace to speak, to quote a widely read political essay of recent date, of Germany where all the social and political forces of modern civilization have reached their most advanced form. How little there was of inevitability in all this, and how much is the result of deliberate policy, becomes clear when we consider the position in England until 1931, and the development since that year in which Great Britain also embarked upon a policy of general protection. It is only a dozen years since, except for a few industries which had obtained protection earlier, British industry was on the whole as competitive as perhaps at any time in its history. And although during the 1920s it suffered severely from incompatible policies followed with regard to wages and to money, at least the years up to 1929 compare with regard to employment and general activity not unfavorably with the 1930s. It is only since the transition to protection and the general change in British economic policy accompanying it that the growth of monopolies has proceeded at an amazing rate and has transformed British industry to an extent the public has scarcely yet realized. To argue that this development has anything to do with the technological progress during this period, that technological necessities which in Germany operated in the 1880s and 1890s made themselves felt here in the 1930s, is not much less absurd than the claim implied in a statement of Mussolini that Italy had to abolish individual freedom before other European people because its civilization had marched so far in advance of the rest. Insofar as England is concerned, the thesis that the change in opinion and policy merely follows an inexorable change in the facts can be given a certain appearance of truth just because the nation has followed at a distance the intellectual developments elsewhere. It could thus be argued that monopolistic organization of industry grew up in spite of the fact that public opinion still favored competition, but that outside events frustrated their wishes. The true relation between theory and practice becomes, however, clear as soon as we look to the prototype of this development, Germany. That there the suppression of competition was a matter of deliberate policy, that it was undertaken in the service of the ideal which we now call planning, there can be no doubt. Of advance toward a completely planned society, Germans and all the people who are imitating their example are merely following the course which 19th century thinkers, particularly Germans, have mapped out for them. The intellectual history of the last 60 or 80 years is indeed a perfect illustration of the truth that in social evolution nothing is inevitable but thinking makes it so. The assertion that modern technological progress makes planning inevitable can also be interpreted in a different manner. It may mean that the complexity of our modern industrial civilization creates new problems with which we cannot hope to deal effectively except by central planning. In a sense, this is true, yet not in the wide sense in which it is claimed. It is, for example, a commonplace that many of the problems created by a modern town, like many other problems caused by close contiguity in space, are not adequately solved by competition. But it is not these problems, like those of the public utilities, etc., which are uppermost in the minds of those who invoke the complexity of modern civilization as an argument for central planning. What they generally suggest is that the increasing difficulty of obtaining a coherent picture of the complete economic process is indispensable that things should be coordinated by some central agency if social life is not to dissolve in chaos. This argument is based on a complete misapprehension of the working of competition. Far from being appropriate only to comparatively simple conditions, it is the very complexity of the division of labor under modern conditions which makes competition the only method by which such coordination can be adequately brought about. There would be no difficulty about efficient control or planning were conditions so simple that a single person or board could effectively survey all the relevant facts. It is only as the factors which have to be taken into account become so numerous that it is impossible to gain a synoptic view of them that decentralization becomes imperative. But once decentralization is necessary, the problem of coordination arises, a coordination which leaves the separate agencies free to adjust their activities to the facts which only they can know, and yet brings about a mutual adjustment of their respective plans. As decentralization has become necessary because nobody can consciously balance all the considerations bearing on the decisions of so many individuals, the coordination can clearly be effected not by conscious control, but only by arrangements which convey to each agent the information he must possess in order effectively to adjust his decisions to those of others. And because all the details of the changes constantly affecting the conditions of demand and supply of the different commodities can never be fully known or quickly enough be collected and disseminated by any one center, what is required is some apparatus of registration which automatically records all the relevant effects of individual actions and whose indications are at the same time the resultant of and the guide for all the individual decisions. This is precisely what the price system does under competition, and which no other system even promises to accomplish. It enables entrepreneurs, by watching the movement of comparatively few prices as an engineer watches the hands of a few dials, to adjust their activities to those of their fellows. The important point here is that the price system will fulfill this function only if competition prevails, that is, if the individual producer has to adapt himself to price changes and cannot control them. The more complicated the whole, the more dependent we become on that division of knowledge between individuals whose separate efforts are coordinated by the impersonal mechanism for transmitting the relevant information known by us as the price system. It is no exaggeration. We had to rely on conscious central planning for the growth of our industrial system. It would never have reached the degree of differentiation, complexity, and flexibility it has attained. Compared with this method of solving the economic problem by means of decentralization plus automatic coordination, the more obvious method of central direction is incredibly clumsy, primitive, and limited in scope. That the division of labor has reached the extent which makes modern civilization possible, we owe to the fact that it did not have to be consciously created, but that man tumbled on a method by which the division of labor could be extended far beyond the limits within which it could have been planned. Any further growth of its complexity, therefore, far from making central direction more necessary, makes it more important than ever that we should use a technique which does not depend on conscious control. There is yet another theory which connects the growth of monopolies with technological progress, and which uses arguments almost opposite to those we have just considered. Though not often clearly stated, it has also exercised considerable influence. It contends not that modern technique destroys competition, but that, on the contrary, it will be impossible to make use of any of the new technological possibilities unless protection against competition is granted, that is, a monopoly is conferred. This type of argument is not necessarily fraudulent, as the critical reader will perhaps suspect. The obvious answer, that if a new technique for satisfying our wants is really better, it ought to be able to stand up against all competition, does not dispose of all instances to which this argument refers. No doubt in many cases it is used merely as a form of special pleading by interested parties. Even more often it is probably based on a confusion between technical excellence from a narrow engineering point of view and desirability from the point of view of society as a whole. There remains, however, a group of instances where the argument has some force. It is, for example, at least conceivable that the British automobile industry might be able to supply a car cheaper and better than cars used to be in the United States if everyone in England were made to use the same kind of car, or that the use of electricity for all purposes could be made cheaper than coal or gas if everybody could be made to use only electricity. In instances like these, it is at least possible that we might all be better off or should prefer the new situation if we had the choice, but that no individual ever gets the choice, because the alternative is either that we should all use this cheap car, or all should use only electricity, or that we should have the choice between these things, with each of them at a much higher price. I do not know whether this is true in either of the instances given, but it must be admitted that it is possible that by compulsory standardization or the prohibition of variety beyond a certain degree, abundance might be increased in some fields more than sufficiently to compensate for the consumer. It is even conceivable that a new invention may be made some day, whose adoption would seem unquestionably beneficial, but which could be used only if many or all people were made to avail themselves of it at the same time. Whether such instances are of any great or lasting importance, they are certainly not instances where it could be legitimately claimed that technical progress makes central direction inevitable. They would merely make it necessary to choose between gaining a particular advantage by compulsion and not obtaining it, or in most instances obtaining it a little later, when further technical advance has overcome the particular difficulties. It is true that in such situations we may have to sacrifice a possible immediate gain as the price of our freedom, but we avoid, on the other hand, the necessity of making future developments dependent upon the knowledge which particular people now possess. By sacrificing such advantages, we preserve an important stimulus to further progress. Though in the short run the price we have to pay for variety and freedom of choice may sometimes be high, in the long run, even material progress will depend on this very variety, because we can never predict from which of the many forms in which a good or service can be provided something better may develop. It cannot, of course, be asserted that the preservation of freedom at the expense of some addition to our present material comfort will be thus rewarded in all instances. But the argument for freedom is precisely that we ought to leave room for the unforeseeable free growth. It applies, therefore, no less when, on the basis of our present knowledge, compulsion would seem to bring only advantages, and although in a particular instance it may actually do no harm. In much of the current discussion on the effect of technological progress, this progress is presented to us as if it were something outside us which could compel us to use the new knowledge in a particular way. While it is true, of course, that inventions have given us tremendous power, it is absurd to suggest that we must use this power to destroy our most precious inheritance, liberty. It does mean, however, that if we want to preserve it, we must guard it more jealously than ever, and that we must be prepared to make sacrifices for it. While there is nothing in modern technological developments which forces us toward comprehensive economic planning, there is a great deal in them which makes infinitely more dangerous the power a planning authority would possess. While there can thus be little doubt that the movement toward planning is the result of deliberate action, and that there are no external necessities which force us to it, it is worth inquiring why so large a proportion of the technical experts should be found in the front rank of the planners. The explanation of this phenomenon is closely connected with an important fact which the critics of the planners should always keep in mind, that there is little question that almost every one of the technical ideals of our experts could be realized within a comparatively short time if to achieve them were made the sole aim of humanity. There is an infinite number of good things, which we all agree are highly desirable as well as possible, but of which we cannot hope to achieve more than a few within our lifetime, or which we can hope to achieve only very imperfectly. It is the frustration of his ambitions in his own field which makes the specialist revolt against the existing order. We all find it difficult to bear to see things left undone which everybody must admit are both desirable and possible. That these things cannot all be done at the same time, that any one of them can be achieved only at the sacrifice of others, can be seen only by taking into account factors which fall outside any specialism, which can be appreciated only by a painful intellectual effort, the more painful as it forces us to see against a wider background the objects to which most of our labors are directed, and to balance them against others which lie outside our immediate interest, and for which, for that reason, we care less. Every one of the many things which, considered in isolation, it would be possible to achieve in a planned society, creates enthusiasts for planning who feel confident that they will be able to instill into the directors of such a society their sense of the value of the particular objective, and the hopes of some of them would undoubtedly be fulfilled, since a planned society would certainly further some objectives more than is the case at present. It would be foolish to deny that the instances of planned or semi-planned societies which we know do furnish illustrations in point, good things which the people of these countries owe entirely to planning. The magnificent motor roads in Germany and Italy are an instance often quoted, even though they do not represent a kind of planning not equally possible in a liberal society. But it is equally foolish to quote such instances of technical excellence in particular fields as evidence of the general superiority of It would be more correct to say that such extreme technical excellence out of line with general conditions is evidence of a misdirection of resources. Anyone who has driven along the famous German motor roads and found the amount of traffic on them less than on many a secondary road in England can have little doubt that, so far as peace purposes are concerned, there was little justification for them. Whether it was not a case where the planners decided in favor of guns instead of butter is another matter. Footnote. But as I am correcting this, the news comes that maintenance work on the German motor roads has been suspended. But by our standards, there is little ground for enthusiasm. The illusion of the specialist that in a planned society he would secure more attention to the objectives for which he cares most is a more general phenomenon than the term specialist at first suggests. In our predilections and interests, we are all in some measure specialists, and we all think that our personal order of values is not merely personal, but that in a free discussion among rational people, we would convince the others that ours is the right one. The lover of the countryside, who wants above all that its traditional appearance should be preserved, and that the blots already made by industry on its fair face should be removed, no less than the health enthusiast who wants all the picturesque but insanitary old cottages cleared away, or the motorist who wishes the country cut up by big motor roads, the efficiency fanatic who desires the maximum of specialization and mechanization, no less than the idealist who for the development of personality wants to preserve as many independent craftsmen as possible, all know that their aim can be fully achieved only by planning, and they all want planning for that reason. But, of course, the adoption of the social planning for which they clamor can only bring out the concealed conflict between their aims. The movement for planning owes its present strength largely to the fact that, while planning is in the main still an ambition, it unites all-minded idealists, all the men and women who have devoted their lives to a single task. The hopes they place in planning, however, are the result not of a comprehensive view of society, but rather of a very limited view, and often the result of a great exaggeration of the importance of the ends they place foremost. This is not to underrate the great pragmatic value of this type of men in a free society like ours, which makes them the subject of just admiration, but it would make the very men who are most anxious to plan society the most dangerous if they were allowed to do so, and the most intolerant of the planning of others. From the saintly and single-minded idealist to the fanatic is often but a step, though it is the resentment of the frustrated specialist which gives the demand for planning its strongest impetus. There could hardly be a more unbearable and more irrational world than one in which the most eminent specialists in each field were allowed to proceed unchecked with the realization of their ideals. Nor can coordination, as some planners seem to imagine, become a new specialism. The economist is the last to claim that he has the knowledge which the coordinator would need. His plea is for a method which effects such coordination without the need for an omniscient dictator. But that means precisely the retention of some such impersonal and often unintelligible checks on individual efforts as those against which all specialists chafe. Chapter 5. Planning and Democracy. The statesman who should attempt to direct private people in what manner they ought to employ their capitals would not only load himself with a most unnecessary attention, but assume an authority which could safely be trusted to no council and senate whatever, and which would nowhere be so dangerous as in the hands of a man who had folly and presumption enough to fancy himself fit to exercise it. Adam Smith. The common features of all collectivist systems may be described in a phrase ever dear to socialists of all schools, as the deliberate organization of the labors of society for a definite social goal. That our present society lacks such conscious direction toward a single aim, that its activities are guided by the whims and fancies of irresponsible individuals, has always been one of the main complaints of its socialist critics. In many ways, very clear, directs us at once to the point where the conflict arises between individual freedom and collectivism. The various kinds of collectivism come nature of the goal toward which, but they all differ from liberal of society and all its resources, and in refusing to recognize autonomous spheres in which the ends of the individuals are supreme. In short, they are totalitarian in the true sense of this new word which we have adopted to describe the unexpected but nevertheless inseparable manifestations of what in theory we call collectivism. The social goal or common purpose for which society is to be organized, is usually vaguely described as the common good, the general welfare, or the general interest. It does not need much reflection to see that these terms have no sufficiently definite meaning to determine a particular course of action. The welfare and the happiness of millions cannot be measured on a single scale of less and more. The welfare of a people, like the happiness of a man, depends on a great many things that can be provided in an infinite variety of combinations. It cannot be adequately expressed as a single end, but only as a hierarchy of ends, a comprehensive scale of values in which every need of every person is given its place. To direct all our activities according to a single plan presupposes that every one of our needs is given its rank in an order of values which must be complete enough to make it possible to decide among all the different courses which the planner has to choose. It presupposes, in short, the existence of a complete ethical code in which all the different human values are allotted their due place. The conception of a complete ethical code is unfamiliar, and it requires some effort of imagination to see what it involves. We are not in the habit of thinking of moral codes as more or less complete. The fact that we are constantly choosing between different values without a social code prescribing how we ought to choose does not surprise us and does not suggest to us that our moral code is incomplete. In our society, there is neither occasion nor reason why people should develop common views about what should be done in such situations. But where all the means to be used are the property of society and are to be used in the name of society according to a unitary plan, a social view about what ought to be done must guide all decisions. In such a world, we should soon find that our moral code is full of gaps. We are not concerned here with the question whether it would be desirable to have such a complete ethical code. It may merely be pointed out that up to the present, the growth of civilization has been accompanied by a steady diminution of the sphere in which individual actions are bound by fixed rules. The rules of which our common moral code consists have progressively become fewer and more general in character. From the primitive man, who was bound by an elaborate ritual in almost every one of his daily activities, who was limited by innumerable taboos, and who could scarcely conceive of doing things in a way different from his fellows, morals have more and more tended to become merely limits circumscribing the sphere within which the individual could behave as he liked. The adoption of a common ethical code comprehensive enough to determine a unitary economic plan would mean a complete reversal of this tendency. The essential point for us is that no such complete ethical code exists. The attempt to direct all economic activity according to a single plan would raise innumerable questions to which the answer could be provided only by a moral rule, but to which existing morals have no answer, and where there exists no agreed view on what ought to be done. People will have either no definite views or conflicting views on such questions, because in the free society in which we have lived, there has been no occasion to think about them and still less to form opinions about them. Not only do we not possess such an all-inclusive scale of values, it would be impossible for any mind to comprehend the infinite variety of different needs of different people which compete for the available resources and to attach a definite weight to each. For our problem, it is of minor importance whether the ends for which any prayers and only individual needs, whether they include the needs of his closer or even those of his more distant fellows, whether he is egoistic or altruistic in the ordinary senses of these words. The point which is so important is the basic fact that it is impossible for any man to survey more than a limited field to be aware of the urgency of more than a limited number of needs. Whether his interests center round his own physical needs, or whether he takes a warm interest in the welfare of every human being he knows, the ends about which he can be concerned will always be only an infinitesimal fraction of the needs of all men. This is the fundamental fact on which the whole philosophy of individualism is based. It does not assume, as is often asserted, that man is egoistic or selfish or ought to be. It merely starts from the indisputable fact that the limits of our powers of imagination make it impossible to include in our scale of values more than a sector of the needs of the whole society, and that since, strictly speaking, scales of value can exist only in individual minds, nothing but partial scales of values exist, scales which are inevitably different and often inconsistent with each other. From this, the individualist concludes that the individuals should be allowed, within defined limits, to follow their own values and preferences rather than somebody else's, that within these spheres the individual's system of ends should be supreme and not subject to any dictation by others. It is this recognition of the individual as the ultimate judge of his ends, the belief that as far as possible his own views ought to govern his actions, that forms the essence of the individualist position. This view does not, of course, exclude the recognition of social ends, or rather of a coincidence of individual ends which makes it advisable for men to combine for their pursuit. But it limits such common action to the instances where individual views coincide. What are called social ends are for it merely identical ends of many individuals, or ends to the achievement of which individuals are willing to contribute in return for the assistance they receive in the satisfaction of their own desires. Common action is thus limited to the fields where people agree on common ends. Very frequently, these common ends will not be ultimate ends to the individuals, but means which different persons can use for different purposes. In fact, people are most likely to agree on common action where the common end is not an ultimate end to them, but a means capable of serving a great variety of purposes. When individuals combine in a joint effort to realize ends they have in common, the organizations, like the state, that they form for this purpose are given their own system of ends and their own means. But any organization thus formed remains one person among others, in the case of the state much more powerful than any of the others, it is true, yet still with its separate and limited sphere in which alone its ends are supreme. The limits of this sphere are determined by the extent to which the individuals agree on particular ends, and the probability that they will agree on a particular course of action necessarily decreases as the scope of such action extends. There are certain functions of the state on the exercise of which there will be practical unanimity among its citizens. There will be others on which there will be agreement of a substantial majority, and so on until we come to fields where, although each individual might wish the state to act in some way, there will be almost as many views about what the government should do as there are different people. We can rely on voluntary agreement to guide the action of the state only so long as it is confined to spheres where agreement exists. But not only when the state undertakes direct control in fields where there is no such agreement is it bound to suppress individual freedom. We can unfortunately not indefinitely extend the sphere of common action and still leave the individual free in his own sphere. Once the communal sector, in which the state controls all the means, exceeds a certain proportion of the whole, the effects of its actions dominate the whole system. Although the state controls directly the use of only a large part of the available resources, the effect of its decisions on the remaining part of the economic system becomes so great that indirectly it controls almost everything. Whereas was, for example, true in Germany as early as 1928, the central and local authorities directly controlled the use of more than half the national income, according to an official German estimate then, 53%, they control indirectly almost the whole economic life of the nation. There is then scarcely an individual end which is not dependent for its achievement on the action of the state, and the social scale of values which guides the state's action must embrace practically all individual ends. It is not difficult to see what must be the consequences when democracy embarks upon a course of planning which in its execution requires more agreement than in fact exists. The people may have agreed on adopting a system of directed economy because they have been convinced that it will produce great prosperity. In the discussions leading to the decision, the goal of planning will have been described by some such term as common welfare, which only conceals the absence of real agreement on the ends of planning. Agreement will in fact exist only on the mechanism to be used, but it is a mechanism which can be used only for a common end, and the question of the precise goal toward which all activity is to be directed will arise as soon as the executive power has to translate the demand for a singular plan. Then it will appear that the agreement on the desirable planning is not supported by agreement on the ends the plan is to The effect of the people must be central planning, without agreeing on the ends, will be rather as if a group of people were to commit themselves to take a journey together without agreeing where they want to go, with the result that they may all have to make a journey which most of them do not want at all. That planning creates a situation in which it is necessary for us to agree on a much larger number of topics than we have been used to, and that in a planned system we cannot confine collective action to the tasks on which we can agree, but are forced to produce agreement on everything in order that any action can be taken at all, is one of the features which contributes more than most to determining the character of a planned system. It may be the unanimously expressed will of the people that its parliament should prepare a comprehensive economic plan, yet neither the people nor its representatives need therefore be able to agree on any particular plan. The inability of democratic assemblies to carry out what seems to be a clear mandate of the people will inevitably cause dissatisfaction with democratic institutions. Parliaments come to be regarded as ineffective talking shops, unable or incompetent to carry out the tasks for which they have been chosen. The conviction grows that if efficient planning is to be done, the direction must be taken out of politics and placed in the hands of experts, permanent officials or independent autonomous bodies. The difficulty is well known to socialists. It will soon be half a century since the Webbs began to complain of the increased incapacity of the House of Commons to cope with its work. More recently, Professor Lasky has elaborated the argument. It is common ground that the present parliamentary machine is quite unsuited to pass rapidly a great body of complicated legislation. The national government, indeed, has in substance admitted this by implementing its economy and tariff measures, not by detailed debate in the House of Commons, but by a wholesale system of delegated legislation. A Labour government would, I presume, build upon the amplitude of this precedent. It would confine the House of Commons to the two functions it can properly perform, the ventilation of grievances and the discussion of general principles of its measures. Its bills would take the form of general formulae conferring wide powers on the appropriate government departments, and those powers would be exercised by order in council, which could, if desired, be attacked in the House by means of a vote of no confidence. The necessity and value of delegated legislation has recently been strongly reaffirmed by the Donimore Committee, and its extension is inevitable if the process of socialization is not to be wrecked by the normal methods of obstruction which existing parliamentary procedure sanctions. And to make it quite clear that a socialist government must not allow itself to be too much fettered by democratic procedure, Professor Lasky at the end of the same article raised the question whether in a period of transition to socialism a Labour government can risk the overthrow of its measures as a result of the next general election, and left it significantly unanswered. Footnote. In a book in which Professor Lasky later elaborated these ideas, his determination that parliamentary democracy must not be allowed to form an obstacle to the realization of socialism is even more plainly expressed. Not only would a socialist government take vast powers and legislate under them by ordinance and decree, and suspend the classic formulae of normal opposition, but the continuance of parliamentary government would depend on its, that is, the Labour government's, possession of guarantees from the Conservative Party that its work of transformation would not be disrupted by repeal in the event of its defeat at the polls. As Professor Lasky invokes the authority of the Donimore Committee, it may be worth recalling that Professor Lasky was a member of that committee and presumably one of the authors of its report. It is important clearly to see the causes of this admitted ineffectiveness of parliaments when it comes to a detailed administration of the economic affairs of a nation. The fault is neither with the individual representatives nor with the parliamentary institutions as such, but with the contradictions inherent in the task with which they are charged. They are not asked to act where they can agree, but to produce agreement on everything, the whole direction of the resources of the nation. For such a task, the system of majority decision is, however, not suited. Majorities will be found where it is a choice between limited alternatives, but it is a superstition to believe that there must be a majority view on everything. There is no reason why there should be a majority in favor of any one of the different possible courses of positive action if their number is legion. Every member of the Legislative Assembly might prefer some particular plan for the direction of economic activity to no plan. Yet no one plan may appear preferable to a majority to no plan at all. Nor can a coherent plan be achieved by breaking it up into parts and voting on particular issues. A Democrat Assembly voting and amending a comprehensive economic plan clause by clause, as it deliberates on an ordinary bill, makes nonsense. An economic plan, to deserve the name, must have a unitary conception. Even if a Parliament could, proceeding step by step, agree on some scheme, it would certainly in the end satisfy nobody. A complex whole in which all the parts must be most carefully adjusted to each other cannot be achieved through a compromise between conflicting views. To draw up an economic plan in this fashion is even less possible than, for example, successfully to plan a military campaign by democratic procedure. As in strategy, it would become inevitable to delegate the task to the experts. Yet the difference is that while the general who is put in charge of a campaign is given a single end to which, for the duration of the campaign, all the means under his control have to be exclusively devoted, there can be no such single goal the economic planner, and no similar limit means imposed upon him. The general has not got to balance different independent aims against each other. There is for him only one supreme goal. But the ends of an economic plan, or of any part of it, cannot be defined apart from the particular plan. It is the essence of the economic problem that the making of an economic plan involves the choice between conflicting or competing ends, different needs of different people. But which ends do so conflict, which will have to be sacrificed if we want to achieve certain others, in short, which are the alternatives between which we must choose, can only be known to those who know all the facts, and only they, the experts, are in a position to decide which of the different ends are to be given preference. It is inevitable that they should impose their scale of preferences on the community for which they plan. This is not always clearly recognized, and delegation is usually justified by the technical character of the task. But this does not mean that only the technical detail is delegated, or even that the inability of parliaments to understand the technical detail is the root of the difficulty. This book is continued on Cassette 3, Side 1.